Somebody's hair. All right, take it off. I'll give you a clear. Oh, it's not coming off.
Okay, don't worry about it. Don't worry.
Hit the wrong button. I'm still on still.
Okay, welcome everybody. I appreciate your coming, and we've got great participation today. I think there's only a couple of, or maybe even one, of the science team members who couldn't make it today. I appreciate that. There was short notice for all of you in particular, and it's great that you found the time to do this. My name is John Ugaretz. I am the Department of Fish and Game's Marine Life Protection Act and Nearshore Ecosystem Coordinator. I am responsible for staff from Morro Bay to Monterey or Santa Cruz, and the lead on this Marine Life Protection Act initiative for the department. We have a variety of other staff people in the room today from the department. Mr. Paul Riley, senior biologist from our Monterey office. Paul's going to be taking notes today. And Dave Parker, one of our senior biologists from the Los Alamitos office. Paul and Dave are two of my senior staff working on the Marine Life Protection Act and other MPA issues. Paul will be our regional coordinator for the Central Coast region when that gets going. And Dave is our statewide coordinator for MPA staffing issues and the mandate itself. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Patty Wolf, our Marine Region Manager, who's here to welcome you on behalf of the director.
Thanks, John. As John said, I'm Patty Wolf. I'm the Marine Region's Manager with the Department of Fish and Game. And first, I want to welcome everyone and thank everybody for braving the weather to get here and get here on time. And thank you in advance for braving the weather on the way home, because I think it's going to be just as challenging. Director Ryan Broderick wanted me to tell you that he wishes he could be here today to thank you for your willingness to serve on the Master Plan Science Advisory Team. The director also wants you to know that Secretary Mike Chrisman And Governor Schwarzenegger, value the contribution that I know each of you will make to the Marine Life Protection Act, or the MLPA initiative. As many of you know, budget constraints and other challenges have slowed the implementation of the Marine Life Protection Act, approved by the legislature and then-governor some 5 years ago. Under Secretary Chrisman's leadership, the Resources Agency and the Department of Fish and Game have developed a new approach to implementing the Marine Life Protection Act, and this is emphasizing public input and sound science, and is also well supported by a combination of state and philanthropic funds. The MLP initiative process intends to meet the mandates of the Marine Life Protection Act through a Blue Ribbon Task Force of policy advisors who will develop recommendations regarding a master plan framework and alternatives for a network of marine protected areas along the Central Coast. And you will hear more details about both of these important and major pieces of the MLPA initiative. The credibility of the Blue Ribbon Task Force recommendations to the department and ultimately to the Fish and Game Commission, which is the decision-making body about this, rests heavily on thorough scientific analysis. Policymakers are counting on this team and this science advisory team to look at a large body of scientific work and to distill that information into a product that is both meaningful and understandable. In fact, your charge is to construct the scientific sideboards that will guide the policymakers in the design and implementation of the Marine Life Protection Act and the MPAs that will result from it. The director is not asking for absolutes from you. He is rather asking for probabilities, your best assessment of the biological aspects of marine protected areas based on science that is readily available. We know that the work ahead is substantial and that the schedule is ambitious. I can assure you that Director Broderick, Secretary Chrisman, and Governor Schwarzenegger support this initiative, and they are committed to providing the necessary leadership and to implement the MLPA initiative in a timely, informed, and transparent manner. And I know that that's important because several of you have been involved in this in the past. Welcome back to this new version. Once again, on behalf of Director Broderick and on my part, I want to thank you for your commitment of your time, your expertise, and your energy. This is important work, and we all believe it will help put California at the forefront of effective marine resources management. I also want to announce, and pleased to announce, the participation of three additional individuals, specifically two people on involved in the science advisory team and then a new department member. Dr. Stephen Barringer, here on John's left, has been appointed by Director Broderick as the chair of the science advisory team. Dr. Barringer has a PhD in engineering economic systems from Stanford. He has considerable experience in designing and organizing and facilitating quality decision-making in marine ecosystem management and also in a wide variety of other applications. He's going to be in a unique role in this group as chair. He will help ensure that the science advisory team has productive dialogue, stays on track, provides timely responses, and will assist you in the work that you're going to be doing. He will work closely with John Ugaretz of the Department of Fish and Game and Mike Weber with the MLPA initiative. And this, having a chair who is really not a member of the team per se will make sure that the team members get to focus on, that you all get to focus on your charge, and one of you is not distracted by attempting to be chair of the group. So we think this is going to be a productive way to operate. Dr. Steve Ralston on my right from NOAA Fisheries, Southwest Fisheries Science Center, is newly appointed member of the team. And Dr. Laura Rogers-Bennett, down at the end of the table, is a department employee. Laura was just promoted to Senior Biologist Specialist, and she will be the Marine Life Protection Act Technical Advisor and a member of the Steering Committee and representing the department there. And one of her major jobs is to work with the Science Advisory Team. I appreciate the willingness, especially Dr. Barringer and Dr. Ralston, for joining us on such short notice. And with that, again, I thank you all. And to whom do I turn it over? John Curlin.
I'm John Curlin. I'm the executive director of the MLPA Initiative, which is some responsibility for herding cats. Stepped into an ongoing process beginning in November. And two words of self-introduction. I have more than 30 years of experience in complex policy processes, some resources, environmental issues, almost totally on the dry side. But what I am responsible for is trying to keep the process on track, honest, and help facilitate meeting a very ambitious schedule. It's an innovative public-private process. I think it has great promise. I would be involved with it. And your roles will be very critical, and I thank you for your participation. We don't yet even have fully operational phones or business cards, but we are accessible. And John, actually, in the Department of Fishing Game, is a good contact to get to the rest of us. I chair the steering committee, which is the group which has the day-to-day operational responsibility of moving things forward, taking things to the Blue Ribbon Task Force, which will then send them to the department and the Fishing Game Commission for eventual public legitimated decision-making. But your role is very important, and I thank you. I'm impressed by what I know of you, and I look forward to working with you in this process. Thank you.
What I'd like to do now is very quickly, if we could, go around the table, just in case some of you don't know who each other are, what your backgrounds and expertise are, and where you come from. And Steve, maybe we'll just start at your end of the table there and work our way around. Just a brief statement, what sort of science you do, and what you think you can bring to the table.
And if you could speak up, the miking is limited in here, so if everybody could use their speaking voices, it would be real beneficial for the recording process.
My name is Steve Gaines. I'm the director of the Marine Science Institute at UC Santa Barbara. I'm a marine ecologist, and I've done a wide range of research on marine reserve issues, both studying marine reserves in the field as well as their modeling.
I'm Lou Botsford, University of California, Davis. I work in fisheries and population dynamics. Most of the work on marine reserves has been on what spatial characteristics of reserves will make populations sustainable in reserves.
I'm Mark Oman on the faculty of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. I'm a pelagic ecologist. My principal expertise is the ecology of marine zooplankton. I'm very interested in low-frequency changes in the North Pacific and the responses of marine ecosystems, especially pelagic marine ecosystems, to environmental forcing.
I'm Linwood Pendleton. I'm a core faculty member in the Environmental Science and Engineering program at UCLA. I'm an economist. I have 2 degrees in biology, though. And I study the valuation of non-market resources, especially coastal resources, and especially non-consumptive coastal resources.
I'm Steve Murray. I'm a faculty member at California State University Fullerton. I'm a coastal marine ecologist working largely in nearshore and intertidal systems, and done some work looking at MPA effectiveness in terms of looking at shore visitation and other types of human impacts in those systems.
I'm Steve Palumbi. I'm a professor in biology at Stanford and based at the Hopkins Marine Station in Monterey. My work is mostly in marine population biology, particularly how different marine populations are connected by larval dispersal along great distances.
I'm Dean Wendt. I'm an assistant professor at Cal Poly in the Biological Sciences Department and the Center for Coastal Marine Science. My expertise is in ecology and physiology of marine invertebrates. Historically, I've recently become involved in collaborative fisheries research, working with commercial and recreational fishermen to assess populations in the Morro Bay area.
My name is Doyle Hannon. About 5 years ago, I retired from Cal Fish and Game as a senior marine biologist. My research and work there was with marine mammals and also fisheries. I've had a lot of experience with the Fishery Management Council, working with various fishery management plans. Currently, I'm working as a consultant. I have my own consulting company, working in various areas of marine mammals and fisheries.
My name is Mike Weber. I'm the Senior Project Manager for the MLPA Initiative. Previously, I was a Marine Advisor to the Fish and Game Commission for 4 years. I'm a freelance writer and researcher, so I'll be doing a lot of the writing. Before that, I was Special Assistant to the Director of the National Marine Fisheries Service. I've been around marine protected areas for about 25 years, beginning with the Channel Islands Marine Sanctuary Association.
I'm Steve Berger. Just to add to what Patty said, my career and education are really in decision-making and decision-making processes. And for about 25 years, I worked with large corporations like General Motors or Hewlett Packard on just this sort of complicated decision, high-level decision. So I don't know much about marine systems or ecology. I'm trying to learn. I'm really interested in it. I've been crab fishing with Steve Ralston.
Shellfish.
So in my role here is not to supply information, but more to try to facilitate the dialogue, and so that what we all know, particularly what you know, gets into the hands of the decision makers in a way that makes sense.
My name is Steve Ralston. I work for NOAA Fisheries, Southwest Fishery Science Center at the Santa Cruz Laboratory. I do ground fish stock assessments, principally rockfish sorts of work, and lead the fishery oceanography program there. I also chair the ground fish committee on the scientific and statistical committee of the Pacific Fishery Management Council for the last 5 years. Prior to that, I was a member of the ground fish management committee.
My name is Bill Seidman. I'm the Director of Marine Ecology at PRBO Conservation Science, which was formerly Point Reyes Bird Observatory. I'm a seabird ecologist by training. Been working with fish and game on and off for a number of years on some fisheries management issues, and I have a series of MPA-related projects ongoing, mainly in the offshore pelagic realm. Particularly interested in seabirds as indicators of hotspots in marine ecosystems.
My name is Rick Avitek. I'm a professor at Cal State Monterey Bay, and I'm also the director of the seafloor mapping lab there. My background is as a benthic ecologist, particularly benthic disturbance. That got me into high-resolution acoustic mapping and characterization of seafloor habitats. And so my expertise here is probably of greatest value in the area of GIS and geospatial analysis of seafloor habitats. And I've done a fair amount of mapping for fish and game in proposed MPA areas to help design monitoring programs and identification of control areas.
I'm Mark Carr. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at UC Santa Cruz. My expertise is in reef fish ecology and kelp forest ecology, and I've been involved in marine reserve issues since, I guess, the early 80s, working on mostly design questions and the design of monitoring and evaluation programs.
My name is Jeff Padawan. I'm a physical oceanographer. I'm a professor, associate professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. But I guess I am familiar with the circulation offshore. That's sort of my area of interest in upwelling circulation systems and the California ecosystem from that perspective. I don't know many Latin names, so I will have to rely on the biologist for that. More of a current person.
I'm Rich Starr with the UC Sea Grant Extension Program and adjunct professor at Moss Landing Marine Labs. And my experience has been with fisheries and specifically with MPAs. I study movements of fish in terms of understanding the design of MPAs.
My name is Dave Schaub. I work for California State Parks. I've been involved in the initial committee that came up with the different classification systems for marine areas in California. Our division is involved in policy and recommendations for new terrestrial parks as well as marine. I'm here as the department's representative. As most of you probably know, State Parks has a mission in protecting representative and outstanding natural resource areas of California. And that goes for marine areas as well as terrestrial areas, so that's why I'm here. And I did have a staff person, Dr. Jim Berry, who was on the prior science committee, and he has since retired. So, and has not been replaced, so I'm it.
My name's Astrid Schultz. I'm an ecological economist with EcoTrust up in Portland, Oregon, and an affiliated faculty member at Oregon State University. EcoTrust, for those of you who are intrigued by the name, is a conservation organization promoting a triple bottom line in the greater Pacific Northwest from Alaska to California. And specifically on MPA issues, we've been working with environmental organizations, state agencies, and now the Central California Sanctuaries in a variety of capacities supporting the integration of socioeconomic concerns and fishermen's knowledge into MPA decision processes.
I'm Laura Rogers Bennett. I'm a senior biologist with the Department of Fish and Game and a research associate at UC Davis. My research interests are in subtitle marine ecology, particularly MPAs and marine conservation issues revolving around marine invertebrates.
Okay. Thank you, everybody. As you can see, we have a great, diverse group of people here with, I hope, the expertise we need to answer a lot of tough questions. One thing you'll hear about later is we do have funding in the initiative for short-term contracts, where if you all tell us that we need to look into something, if it's background research or even short-term new research, we can do that. And we'll talk about what we've established already and ask you for your input on that. Again, just for the sake of the video, please speak up. Some of you are kind of soft-spoken naturally, and you've got to learn to be like me and really shout all the time. To get moving with today, what we'd like to do first is talk a little bit about your charge and the operating procedures of this group. Please understand that, you know, Steve has been appointed. We gave him his letter this morning appointing him to the team. So he didn't really spend time preparing for this, as I'm glad he didn't, just in case he didn't get appointed. But
that's my excuse for
that. Yeah, but today Mike, Steve, and I will be running the show, essentially. As this team moves forward, as Patty said, Laura will be the department's representative on this team. And Mike and I will be somewhat on the outskirts, making sure that things get to you and back to the initiative. And Steve will be running the meetings and making sure that all of that flows well. With regards to the charge to the science team, Patty already spoke about it a little. I believe I did send you the draft charter for your team. It's fairly straightforward and doesn't get into a lot of substance, but In a word, the charge to the science team is to provide scientific knowledge and judgment necessary to assist the Blue Ribbon Task Force with meeting the objectives of the initiative. Principally, the science team is charged with assisting the task force in developing a draft master plan framework, which I'll explain in a moment, and commenting on scientific papers, draft documents, and addressing scientific issues presented to this team by the task force or by other entities. In the course of developing recommendations for the draft master plan, members shall refrain from making policy judgments. We don't expect you to make tough policy calls. Rather, where available science presents options or uncertainty, we need you to frame those options and uncertainty to the task force so they can understand the options and make a policy decision. Quickly, as I think we've made aware to you, you are not being reimbursed for your time on this process. However, there is funding available for your travel and expenses for attending science team meetings or other MLPA-related meetings. We sent you a form, and I think Mike can discuss that form in a moment. Maybe not. I don't know. it's a fairly simple form that you fill out and send back to the funders, and they will reimburse you. We do expect you to attend all of the meetings. We will discuss about scheduling a little later. I know we've said previously that we expect meetings to be about every other month. I think it's fairly clear in these first few months that we're going to be meeting slightly more frequently than that, and we can figure out the schedule that works for all of you. The chair, Steve, will also attend the Blue Ribbon Task Force meetings, and we welcome you to attend any of the Blue Ribbon Task Force meetings as well. We can use Steve as the funnel to present your results to the task force and bring their information back to you. As I said earlier, these meetings will be open to the public. We will announce them publicly. They will be videotaped, and we will allow for public comment. These are things that are not optional to you. We need to make this process open. We need to let the public talk to you directly so you understand their concerns and can answer their questions. Otherwise, with regard to your charge, I mentioned the master plan framework. The framework is a document that will look at how do you implement the Marine Life Protection Act throughout the entire state of California. The master plan framework will not be looking at specific marine protected areas or lines on the map. It will be looking at what questions need to be answered in establishing a network of MPAs, what information do you need to choose where to place MPAs, and what is the science supporting the various decisions that you might make. It is just that, a framework, and this document is due in the short term. Now, luckily, you have something to build on. We haven't been sitting still for the past many years, and the prior master plan team, of which several members are present today, has done a lot of work with regards to the framework and MPAs in general that you can build off of. There's also a tremendous body of science that you're all well aware of that you can work from to help develop this framework. The framework is due to the Fish and Game Commission in a draft form in May. And building back from that, that means that we really need to get it to them in April in a document format, which means that between now and April is when we will be going from the annotated outline, which you've seen in your mailing or your email, to an actual document. And obviously that's going to require a lot of heavy lifting. We don't expect you all to be writing this document. We expect you to be helping us with questions that come up, with areas that need to be fleshed out, and questions of your own that you feel need to be part of an adequate framework. The staff will be doing the writing, and contract folks will be helping with the writing, and hopefully we can then provide you with documents that you can help us edit and bring to a full completion. The next phase, once we have that framework, is the Central Coast Pilot Project. We've decided that tackling marine protected areas in the water for the whole state in one bite is just too much to do. There are too many issues that differ from region to region, and it requires a tremendous amount of public input, staff support, scientific input in each region, and in many cases that input is different for each region. Instead, we've decided to focus on a pilot project area within the Central Coast, and the first thing you will be helping us with is recommending to the Blue Ribbon Task Force where that area should be. The bounds are Point Conception and Point Arena. We do not want you to select that whole area. That's too much. We know that already. What we want to do is, based on some criteria that we'll discuss later today, is choose a project area within which we will discuss what is the status of the resources, what are the status of regulations, what existing MPAs are there, and how do you meet the mandates of the Marine Life Protection Act within those areas. That is not simply the question, where do you put reserves, because that's not what we're asking you to focus on. There's a lot more involved, and it is going to be different for each region, and this pilot project will help us learn how to do it. The pilot project draft plan is due to the Fish and Game Commission in August of 2006 for adoption by November of 2006. So your next big critical deadline is really August of 2006 after this first push. We will be establishing a sub-team to work directly on that Central Coast project. That's something that I think we'd like your input on today. Who among you are interested in participating on that subteam? What does the whole team feel needs to be represented on that subteam? And then the subteam will work more closely with the Central Coast Project, a Central Coast working group, and provide input back to the whole team on how that Central Coast process is proceeding. At least one member of that subteam will attend meetings of a Central Coast stakeholder working group. And that will be that stakeholders group linked back to the science team as a whole. That's a lot. You are impaneled between now and November of 2006. You're impaneled at the discretion of the Director of Department of Fish and Game, and of course on a voluntary basis. And with that, I think I want to turn over to Mike a little bit here to talk a little bit more about some operating procedures and maybe a few comments from Steve as well.
Well, there's really not much regarding operating procedures that I'll add since running the meeting is going to be a matter for the chair. But what I did want to come back to a little bit is the schedule over the next several months. We're expecting to have a complete first draft of the master plan by mid-February. Between now and then, we are going to be developing draft sections of the master plan, and we'd like to be able to circulate them by email and get your comments. And then we will be providing that complete draft for review in mid-February. I expect we'll try to have another meeting at that time. Then we will take comments from the public, the task force, the science team, and produce a second draft. And we expect to have that done in sometime in mid-March for a review, once again, by the science team, probably in late March at a meeting. And then we forward that as our preliminary final draft to the task force, and the task force will take up that draft master plan at their April 11th and 12th meeting. So it's going to be an intense next several months, but after that point, the demands are going to lessen, I would expect, pretty considerably. We'll still be continuing to work on the master plan, certainly, but the focus is going to shift probably to the Central Coast. So we will be circulating documents in between meetings, and if you can review them as we're on the fly, that would be terrific. And just one thing that I wanted to add regarding the team and serving on the team. We are really aiming, as John suggested, for a consensus from the team. But if the team does come to an agreement in an area and you're at a meeting of the Fish and Game Commission, you can speak to that and characterize that as a position of the team. Otherwise, when you speak with the Fish and Game Commission, you can also provide your own views, but noting that they are your own views. And what I'll do is I'm going to pass around my calling card so you have my contact information. And feel free to contact me with ideas or requests for information. I'd be happy to do what I can to help you out. And Laura and I will be working together to make sure that you have everything you need to be able to participate and contribute. And I wanted to thank you personally. This is really such a distinguished group of people. I'm looking forward to my work over the next several months, especially.
Just a couple very simple logistical things. Please turn your cell phones to silent, everybody. That will help. And I understand you all are very busy. You're working on a lot of things, and you're providing us your time. But if you could focus your attention and energies on this process while we're here. I know in the computer age we all have a tendency to check our email, work on other documents, etc., while we're at meetings, and I know I've done it myself. But if while we're at these meetings you can focus the day on this, that would be greatly appreciated. Steve? Yes? Go ahead.
May I ask a question?
Absolutely.
Can you
maybe let people know who you are?
Yeah, I'm Bob Strickland. I'm the president of the United Angler's of California. I have a question. I'm not clear on the distinction between the science panel, the blue ribbon panel, and the task force.
Okay, the blue ribbon task force is one group. So there's not a blue ribbon panel and a blue ribbon task force.
All right.
We probably all slip into different phraseology, but the blue ribbon task force. Is a group that was impaneled by the Secretary for Resources. Their role in this process is to provide policy insight and oversight and advice to the Department of Fish and Game. They are charged with preparing the draft framework, preparing a Central Coast recommendation, and two other main charges of preparing input and advice on funding sources for long-term funding and preparing input and advice on how to better coordinate between state and federal agencies in marine protected area issues. That is their primary charge. They do function as an advisory body or recommendary body to the Department of Fish and Game. The Department of Fish and Game then must still bring those recommendations to the Fish and Game Commission, who has the decision-making authority. So please don't confuse the Blue Ribbon Task Force with a decision-making body, as they are only providing recommendations and documents, draft documents, to the department. The science panel is the scientific advice to that task force and also to the department. The Marine Life Protection Act is very clear that any decisions made must be based on the best readily available and sound science, and that is this team's role, is to provide that scientific input to the task force. There are additional panels and teams involved in this process. There is a statewide stakeholder coordination committee, statewide interest group, we changed the name. The statewide interest group is a group of individuals who have broad connections with stakeholders from a variety of groups throughout the state. Their role in the process is to help us with process, to help us involve stakeholders in the various parts of the process, and they may give us advice on how to better involve stakeholders in this process and how to connect to the stakeholders. And then when we get to the Central Coast Project, there will be a stakeholder working group to discuss the specifics of lines on the map in the Central Coast. That group has not been formed yet. We need to know where the Central Coast pilot project is before we choose membership for them. Does that help sort of lay out the various roles?
Yeah, absolutely.
So continuing, Steve, did you have anything to say about process, about the way you run teams?
I think it'll develop as we go along, but just a few words. Like Patty said, that as the chairman's role is to develop dialogue, stay on track, and timely responses, and I'm not going to take responsibility for that. I think we have to do that as a team. My role will be to facilitate, and that means that I'll have to guide the discussion and curtail discussion or something. Change topics and so on, which is going to upset people, I'm sure, at different times. All I ask is that if there are any evaluations of what I'm doing, that you make them public. That is, that we talk about it at the meeting. So if I'm being too abrupt, if I'm spending too much time in one place and not another, please bring it up so we can deal with it on the spot in a timely way. So if there is a rule that I like to follow, it's that there are no secret evaluations. That if something has to do with this team of people,
or individuals on the team that we deal with it as a team, as a group, and not offline. Is that okay with everybody? Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I think this is a good point to ask you all, the team, if you have any questions about, hopefully you know why you're here, but anything about the process, what you're charged with doing. Nothing. That's great. We did a wonderful job of informing everybody.
Is this the team? Is it set?
Good question. Missions? Thank you. That was something I wanted to bring up. As we've all said, this is a great team. There are, I feel, two holes that are still needing to be filled. With the addition of Steve Ralston and input from NOAA Fisheries, I feel we now do have a strong link to fisheries science and regulations in California waters as well as other states. And that's great to have that filled. We need another economist, and I would like to see someone with some real strong fisheries or natural resource economic background. We've had a couple suggestions. Dr. Chris Costello was recommended. He's at UCSB. Dr. Mike Dalton from CSU Monterey Bay was recommended. And Dr. Richard Young, who I'm a little unclear on his current affiliation, but he has a background in economics and actually has worked with the council, I believe, and is currently working in one of the ports and harbors in California. Those are the three names I've got. I don't think we need to spend a lot of time discussing it today, but I'd love to hear your input on those three folks, as well as any other recommendations you might have. But we really do need to get that person on the team, and clearly we need to have it happen soon. We had some excellent recommendations in the nomination process, and as I'm sure all of you are aware, this is a time-intensive process, and people just did not have the time available to commit. That doesn't mean we won't have their input along the road. It means they won't be physically on the team. The other seat that is currently missing is actually one that's mandated by the Marine Life Protection Act. It's a representative from State Water Resources Control Board. We're working with the board to find someone. They, like state parks, had some retirements and are having a difficult time finding the appropriate person to fill that seat. If you all feel that there's something missing from this table, I'd love to hear it. Remembering, of course, that with the addition of two more, we're going to be right up at about 20 people, and frankly, that's very much critical mass for any team to function. So I'm not gonna recommend adding five or six more people to the team. But again, if you feel there's a gap, let us know. You got a gap?
Top die.
Well, I think we've got some folks dealing with population dynamics on the team, but you know, maybe we could discuss whether you think there needs to be, you know, like a modeler or something like that. But I think some of you folks do modeling, so you know, it's we could delve way deep into the specifics, and the question is whether that would be value added to the team or not. So, anybody have a comment about that?
Well, there's expertise on the panel, yeah. Lou especially, obviously. And if Steve's on board permanently, then they're two of the best that I know.
Okay. That's Lou was definitely one of the population people we tagged. We tried to pigeonhole all of you in selecting the team, and I was actually writing down how you described yourselves, and I think we did a fairly good job of knowing what we thought you did and being right about it. That's something we can leave open for discussion. Any other questions or comments from the team? Let me go here and then back over there.
Mike mentioned a time framework for mid-February for the framework plan, and you sent us a document a few days ago, which was a draft of that. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could spend a few minutes just telling us where that draft came from, and is it do you know those over the last couple of weeks, or is it pulling things from it previously? Yeah. I'm curious
sure,
what we're
sure.
starting with.
Yeah, and like I said earlier, we're definitely not starting from scratch. We've known what the Act requires since the Act was implemented, and in many ways that table of contents is pulled directly from the requirements in the Act. In addition, through the first two rounds or phases of the MLPA process, we started work on draft documents. We've certainly pulled back from the mapping work that was done, but there's a lot of legwork that was done, and I'm sure the past master plan team members can inform you about what went into that. So that plays a big role. The document we sent out to you was originally just a table of contents that just listed the sections, and we presented that to the Blue Ribbon Task Force at their first meeting in October. When was their first meeting? October. They provided very little input on it. We got some public comment on that table of contents. We actually had specifically asked the public to look at the table of contents and focus on where they might have questions that need to be addressed within it. This next version is slightly annotated. We've talked a little bit in it about what we're doing to fill out those sections, what contracts we've let, and things like that, as well as a little bit more detail. At the same time, we're working on gathering all the past information that we can use and trying to figure out how it fits in, whether it's still valid or not. So we're actually a little bit further along than what we've presented. This new draft is already generating some good comment from the public as to where they have questions now that they can understand a little bit more. And that's exactly what we want to get out of you all today, is we will run through that table of contents and figure out where the scientific questions are, what needs to be in the framework. Is there a second part to your question? Let's go over here. There was one.
Well, I just said, I was looking at the roster. Is Steve taking Mary's position?
That's Mary. Mary. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Mary didn't get to introduce herself. Here's her card. Mary, watch this real quickly.
I'm Mary Yankovich from NOAA Fisheries. In the same group, really, with Steve in Santa Cruz Laboratory. I'm their habitat ecology team leader. The research that I do and the group that works with me focuses on deep water ground fish habitats. I'm an original member of the MLPA science team. I've advised the Pacific Council on MPA issues as well as essential fish habitat issues.
That's fine. That's good. At this point, both Mary and Steve will be on the team from NOAA Fisheries. And in fact, maybe Mary brought up something good. Just so people know, several members were on the original master plan team. Why don't you sort of raise your hands? Mary, Steve, Lou. Is that it? Parks was on the team, and Fish and Game was on the team. Jim Berry from State Parks was their representative. He's retired, or
yes.
Yeah, he is retired. And Paul Riley and myself represented the department, and we've actually brought Laura in because Laura has such a strong background in actual research and science and publications on these issues that I think she'll be a really good connect with you all and able to talk about things in the same language. Other questions? Yes.
A question about the open nature of the process, which I fully endorse. Some of the documents that you've received here have internal staff draft for discussion only. Where is the line being drawn? I'd like to know specifically if we don't have that designation on the document, can we make it available to interested parties?
Yes, absolutely. Anything you get, you can make available to interested parties.
Good.
I think the document that you got that said internal staff draft was something where I forgot to take that header off. What document? That was the...
The proposed outline.
Yeah, that's fine. That is a public document now. That's fine. And anything you are discussing is available to the public. when we're sending things back and forth inside the department internally, we sometimes put that header on so it's clear to folks what it is. But this is a public venue. So. And I believe that document is now on the web as well. So it should be available. Somebody else over here had a question. Laura.
You were talking about other seats that might be important for the team, and I was thinking more kind of California-centric, maybe, with the exception of Astrid, but I was thinking of Washington State or Oregon.
We tried. again, it's an issue for people, I think, primarily for travel in that case. We actually had some great recommendations for folks from far outside California. We had more than 80 nominations to this team. The selection process was not simple. We had some great folks from outside California who either were not available or they felt that they represented very similar expertise to people who are sitting here today and that they would not add anything new and different. But again, if there's somebody outside the team who you feel would add something new and interesting, who you think is available, interested, let us know and we'll see if we can do it.
I was going to ask a question that we're really not operating in a vacuum. There's a lot of other activity in terms of reserves and on the West Coast. So, as you described it, ultimately the Fish and Game Commission is going to be presented some options and adopt something. How will that interact with other efforts on the West Coast? Is this strictly a state? From a science perspective, it's important to understand scales.
Right. And the Marine Life Protection Act is a state law. It requires that we look only within state waters. Clearly, you all as scientists know that that state-federal waterline boundary at 3 miles is an arbitrary one with regards to species and populations and dynamics. Something you all need to keep aware of is the other processes. And actually, I just wrote down, we've prepared a document for the task force that's a briefing on some of the other California processes that are underway. And we can provide you all with that document just so you're aware of all of the various groups that are looking at either marine protected areas or very closely related issues, and the council in particular. I think it's important when we get to lines on the map phases in these processes to think about how might those lines on the map line up with deeper water habitats outside state waters. But the commission is only going to be making a decision on state waters. Yes, go ahead.
I was just going to add, the task force asked a very similar question and has asked staff to come back with information that will provide them some better idea of what the spatial distribution of various closures are off the California coast, both state and federal, whether they're Defense Department or whatnot. So that's going to very much be part of their consideration of the
to follow up, I mean, with the Channel Islands process, the establishment of the state closed areas constrains in some way what can happen in federal waters. So that type of sequential process is maybe not the most desirable. And so I presume the Fish and Game Commission and Fish and Game will be trying to coordinate their closed areas with federal
absolutely.
Council.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the biggest constraint is the Act itself that does provide some deadlines, and it does provide a very clear direction that we must do this. But scientifically, as I said, it's got to be based on science, and so we do need to consider those other things. And in some cases, the recommendation might be, you know, for something bigger than state waters, and then before the commission adopted it, they would have to decide how to undertake that process.
Just add one more thing. Another deliverable of the initiative is recommendations on coordination between state and federal programs. So that is going to be getting some fairly concerted attention because we realize that there's a need for coordination.
And I think that... unless there's a burning question. Yeah.
And I expect we'll get into this a little bit more in detail, but to what extent are we responding to questions or charges from the Blue Ribbon Task Force, and to what extent are we providing them or have the opportunity to give them direction?
I think it's a little of both. I think that obviously initially they won't have questions for you because they need to start hearing what people are saying and asking and documents before they come up with questions for the team. I think in many ways the documents themselves will bring those questions to you. There may be a section of a document that needs particular scientific advice. Obviously, if you all as a team feel that the task force needs to know something, we want you to bring that forward. So it's a little bit. And I think the discussion we were just having about scope of things brings us nicely to our next agenda item, which is the discussion of Central Coast criteria to help select the Central Coast project. And Paul, could you grab the criteria sheet and put it up on the overhead? Do you have one in your packet? And I'm going to actually, Mike, let you kind of help run this because I've got to step out for 1 second.
Well, let me just start in this by saying I assume you've had a chance to look over the criteria. The criteria themselves have not changed, but what we've done is added some explanatory information to each criterion. The schedule that we're on right now is that the task force will take up these criteria at their meeting next week, Monday and Tuesday of next week, and the idea is that they will adopt the criteria at that time and direct staff to take the criteria back, pull together the information, and come back to them with an assessment of various areas along the Central Coast and perhaps with a recommendation. So the criteria, the immediate focus of the criteria is on selecting this, what I'll call a project area along the Central Coast. And that project area will be the focus of the initiative's work over the next 2 years, basically. I presume that these criteria will also serve as a starting point for determining how we phase in other regions. The idea is to have all regions in the state represented with an NPA network by the year 2011. Sounds like a long time, but it's not. So with that, the criteria, I think, are fairly straightforward, and they represent partly what we think, the kind of information we think we can get our hands on fairly quickly to assist in making this initial judgment. So I'll just leave it at that. If you have questions about the criteria, perhaps we could talk about those. Otherwise, suggestions as well. I mean, it's one of the reasons we're bringing this up here is to find out whether or not we've missed something or there's something there that you don't think is particularly helpful.
Mike, I have a question.
There was quite a bit of work done previously, and my understanding is there was some sort of a south central plan that was developed.
Not that I know of. There were at various, in an initial stage, in the first go-round with the Marine Life Protection Act, there were a set of maps developed, so-called initial draft concepts, but those proved to be generate so much discussion and controversy that it was decided to go back and take a different approach, more of a grassroots approach. In the second phase, there were regional working groups established, and in some areas, the regional working groups got to the point where they were talking about specific areas. I don't know if there were maps that were developed as part of that. I just don't know.
No, there were not. The regional working groups did not get to the point of discussing lines on maps in the second phase of the MLPA process.
Well, there were some discussions that were
twice each.
That were going on outside of the regional working groups that were talking about specific areas. But there isn't a plan that's been developed.
Okay, so we're starting from scratch, basically.
Yeah, I mean, certainly we're building on the past discussions, but it's in the second phase, the working groups basically, as I understand it, went through becoming familiar with the Marine Life Protection Act and discussing regional matters that they should delve into. I think they reached different levels of discussion along the coast, but that's when that process was brought to an end. So we're, in a sense, we're starting from close to scratch.
Thank you.
I, just in terms of what might be missing, at least to, I hope I'm not making the first of many blunders for not being as familiar with the background as others, but the, if I were to use these criteria, it makes sense, but I'm struggling with what they are being applied to. There seems to be something missing at, like, an area that maximizes benefit to the largest number of protected species or something. What are we going to deal in choosing this first area with the question of what's being protected up front, because it's a matter of scale. I don't know if we're talking about rockfish or pelagic fishes or what. And so all of these things are reasonable criteria to me, but they don't, I think they would have different answers applied to them if you don't tackle that other question. Maybe I've missed.
Yeah, I have a similar comment in that all of these criteria are related to human uses, and there's nothing related to the distribution of natural resources. So, because if you're talking about maintaining representative habitat, you need to know the distributions of what the habitats are representative in Central California. And similarly, in terms of physiographic provinces or upwelling regimes, and those that influences connectivity between reserves.
Maybe can we make a statement that it has to be at least this big? And there's some criteria for figuring out how big that is.
Well,
I would say that you'd have to know the distribution of available habitat to make that kind of draw that kind of conclusion. It's a ways downstream.
Well, the aim of these criteria was to get us started at an area along the coast, recognizing that eventually the entire coast is going to have a regional network of MPAs. And some of the issues I think that you're talking about right now are once an area has area of some size has been selected, then we start burrowing into where in that area are the habitats, where are the hotspots, if you will. And right now I'm unaware of, say, a comprehensive state map that would allow us to make a statewide decision. I don't know, is there... Maybe there's another approach to this.
I think there... That's one of the issues. Another one is that these criteria, although they seem to be very well taken, would work if there was absolutely an even distribution of resources up and down the entire state, just complete homogeneity. These would work. But we know that's not true. The resources are distributed heterogeneously, and then there are natural biological communities that come and go as you move north and south up and down the coast, and the criteria that include those would help make it natural borders inside these other criteria. I think that's what Rick was alluding to.
So you're suggesting a criterion that would call for looking at distribution of species and diversity. Recognizing that the information is going to be somewhat uneven and
are you looking for discrete natural breaks?
No, I wasn't suggesting that would be the criteria. I'm not saying what the criteria should be, but in here should be criteria that will allow you to use the distribution of species to help hone in what the natural areas might be.
I think the word that's missing is intensity.
So when I look at users, this is sort of a presence or absence of use, a range of users, and what we really want to know is intensity of use. And the word ports appears in here to describe where fishermen are, but that's a really poor descriptor of where people are fishing. Same thing for recreational fishermen, boaters, and the like. So I think intensity of use is going to be an important criteria, not just range.
If we're thinking about this as a pilot, and we're picking one area because we're going to learn a lot from doing that, this case study, then I think one criteria should be that we're dealing with all the complicated issues here, so that when we go other places along the coast, we'll have struggled with those. So that would steer us away from something that was sort of a slam dunk. So we'd want to cover something that where the border between federal water and state water is an issue. And you know probably the other thing is one where the size of endangered populations is an issue. Do you agree that the reason for choosing this is to learn a lot, as well as to get the first cut at a network? So we should pick something where we're going to learn a lot.
And I think what I'm hearing everybody talk about is some sort of ecological criterion here. And I think that becomes exceedingly important if we are using this as a model, that we're going to do some monitoring on, assessment on. If we haven't picked something that's ecologically meaningful, and then we want to use this as a process to learn from as we design other reserves, if we haven't taken into consideration these ecological factors, we could be getting into a situation where we don't see the sort of outcomes that are potentially available.
Can I make a suggestion on operating procedures? If you want to talk, put your name tag up. It'll make it a little bit easier so people don't get lost in the discussion. So, Rick?
Yeah, just 2 points. One, a counter argument to schemes of choosing the most complex area to start with. Given the rather significant public and political opposition at times to the formation of MPAs, I think you could also argue that you want to pick one that's going to be successful, that will have measurable, demonstrable success as a way to argue for an expansion of the MPA program along the coast. And in conjunction with that statement, in the criteria, I didn't see it explicitly stated, but one of the things I've always argued for is the need to identify comparable control areas that can be used to evaluate the success of whatever MPA is formed, because you have to be able to demonstrate success and be able to measure it against something.
Yeah, I was just going to say the same thing. Go for the project areas where you might be able to have more success early on without a lot of experience, and then tackle the harder areas once we've had a project area successfully tackled under our belt.
Steve?
Yeah, these are described as criteria that would be used to determine where and how large to locate this area is. I'm not even clear what the objective of this area is. And when you talk about success, how do you measure success? What is this being done for? What's the management goal? And I think that's extremely important when you start talking about where and how large an area is in sight. So, can somebody discuss that?
One tricky thing with this discussion is to remember we're not talking about an MPA. We're talking about an area within which we'll discuss MPAs. So that's fundamentally something we all need to keep in our head right now. But with regards to, you know, what is the outer goal, the Marine Life Protection Act provides us with a set of goals and objectives for the statewide network when it's complete. This is one piece of that statewide network, so it would be the first step. Perhaps the second step after Channel Islands to getting there. And that's certainly something we could look at now or later today. I think maybe later today we can talk about the Marine Life Protection Act and what does it say, what does it require, so all of you are very familiar with it. In general, it's of course not terribly specific, but it's looking at providing for sustainable resources over the long term. It has some very specific requirements to replicate habitats in regions, in no-take protected areas, as well as improving the overall marine protected area, not just no-take, component of the state's network. And then maybe one of the biggies that is a tricky one scientifically, it asks that the final network function as a network. And that's something I think you all are going to have to discuss a bit to decide what you think that means.
So is the goal or objective principally a fisheries management objective?
I would say not. It does include in the act sustaining species that are economically important, which in some ways is a fisheries management objective. But there are other objectives with regards to providing locations for science, for study, providing locations for other types of use, et cetera. So there's a lot in there beyond that.
Well, the appendix that you sent that contains the definition of marine protected areas and different types of marine protected areas has pretty well-developed criteria. And they differ significantly between the kinds of marine protected areas. I don't see any direct relationship between these criteria, which should be somehow encompassing, and then these more specific criteria. Socioeconomic criteria, for instance, are very well developed here and include this idea of intensity and economic impact, protection of species. And so we're going to have to know to some degree what kind of goals in marine protected areas we're considering specifically within this larger group of marine protected areas that we're thinking about as a network.
Do you think that those goals are critical to the selection of a project area or more to the selection of actual marine protected areas?
Well, I think it's going to color. I mean, if the project area can't be the whole Central Coast, then knowing, for instance, what the intensity of use is and where biological productivity and diversity is distributed is going to mean we can draw circles around some areas where we're likely to do a good job at protecting both. I mean, there are going to be other places that are clearly going to be very, very difficult and the economic costs of protection are going to be very high. So it would be nice to know that in advance. But you still need to know what the outcome is. Are we protecting it for recreational purposes? Are we protecting it for fisheries management purposes? Are we protecting it for conservation purposes?
Well, one of the complexities of the MLPA, as John suggested, is that there are, I think, seven, if not maybe eight, different objectives. And so you may have a range of objectives for individual MPAs within a network. And in one case, it may be an emphasis on conservation of biological diversity. In another case, it may be to promote recreational uses. Those are questions that I think are probably three levels or four levels down from where we are right now, because this is really trying to determine an area in which we can reasonably apply what is in the master plan regarding the design of an MPA network. That's where a lot of those criteria.
Yeah, I would just disagree in that those kinds of criteria, when applied very specifically, are going to help you target the kinds of marine protected areas you want and where specifically you want them. But if the goal then is to maximize the benefits when you add it all up, when you consider the whole network, then where you decide to focus in the beginning is going to be important. So there's maximization of biological goals or socioeconomic goals within a designated area, but then there's also this sort of societal benefits that you want to look at from the perspective of the state, from the perspective of the region as a large marine ecosystem, or from the perspective of something even bigger. So I'm not saying what those criteria should be, but I think that we should be building off of these criteria that are very well defined here in this document, at least acknowledging that they exist and thinking about them, and I don't see that connection at this point.
How big does the area have to be before you can really design a network of reserves? Yeah, part of this law says that it has to be a network. So it seems like this area has to be big enough that so you can design a real network and not just one or two reserves.
But that depends entirely on the organisms concerned. Mm-hmm. The natural scale of dispersal, the population structure, and the subpopulation structure.
So how, how big an area?
Well, it might be 2 kilometers or it might be 1,000 kilometers.
Depending on the organisms.
Yes.
So given the organisms that are in the Central Coast, how big an area is meaningful to design a network?
I think that's arbitrary. I mean, just to discuss it in that way, I think from the beginning is arbitrary until you see what the distribution of biological organisms and human organisms are. And I think you're going to see when this all plays out that there are areas of overlapping intensity of use. I mean, people that enjoy or utilize marine resources are going to find themselves in places of high diversity and high abundance. So I don't think we're going to find a lot of recreational fishermen where there are no fish. So I think we're going to see this, and I don't think you can start off by saying we need X number of miles or some kind of volumetric approach. I think you need to sort of have a good idea of what the data are first.
Lou, to give you a rough idea, it's hundreds of kilometers. When people talk about networks, they're usually talking about marine reserves that will be connected biologically either through adult migrations or through larval dispersal. So it's on the order of hundreds of kilometers, I would say, the species that we're interested in. That's a really
so is loose number. Point conception of Point Arena big enough?
That would be big.
But it also might be because there may be more than one biological community in that area. So the whole thing might not actually be able to serve as a network. You may be able to subsect it into a smaller area depending on if that area has more than one biological community. But I would agree with Lou, hundreds of kilometers for the approximate scale. And at this point, I think it's going beyond that kind of accuracy.
Okay, back to Lou, and then Rick, Mark, and Bill.
Steve Ralston asked the question whether this was fishery management was a goal, and we said no, in keeping with the Act. I just want to make sure that doesn't mean that fisheries aren't going to be involved in what we talk about, because while they won't necessarily be on the benefit side, they're certainly going to be on the cost side of every reserve we put in. And then the other quick comment I wanted to make sure that we get back to the point that Rick Starr was making, that it's going to be better to choose an area where we know something about the habitat structure so we're going to be able to make these decisions having to do with networks and how big a marine reserve can be. If you don't know where the possible interconnections are, you can't make those decisions.
Rick?
Yeah, I'll just continue a little bit on that. Is that I agree with what Lou said about the distances. Also, we know that there are areas in Central California coast that are confined by upwelling zones, and so those are logical breaks, if you will. And the point I wanted to agree with what Steve made earlier is that I think we're better off including areas where you have to bring different people together, because there are different resources, different resource users. And if one port isn't talking to another port, you're going to end up having problems. And so I think that argues for a little bit larger area than a smaller area.
Okay. Mark?
You know, Bill went vertical before I did, so.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. My comment was the two comments, actually. First of all, the criteria used to select MPAs have been discussed in lots of other meetings, in particular the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary Special MPA Group. We spent quite a bit of time on that, and you know, weeks and over weeks of time. And I think we need really need to review that. I don't think we need to kind of rebuild that, because it's all there. It's just a matter of getting to it and using it. And the other comment was just one that I guess Rick just made about oceanographic
boundaries, and we know a lot about the upwelling system. It's fundamentally an upwelling system, point conception, a point arena. There are certainly points along the coast where upwelling is stronger and upwelling is weaker, and this could be used as kind of a fundamental backbone for how the area is looked at least in an initial cut. I just want to sort of suggest that that's very important to think about as an underlying effort. And then the other part is, again, to get at the natural history of the organisms, how they disperse, how they move, and what the overall distribution is, because that's going to be very important. So natural history and oceanography was sort of two of the areas I think important to start with.
I could just add a process note. Generally, when people are framing problems like this, the error that they make is they get too small, and then they can't get bigger. So I'd suggest that we try to begin with point conception to point arena and figure out why we're making it smaller rather than begin with a small area and try to figure out why we're making it bigger. Because that just seems to be some wisdom above framing.
Mark? Steve, you mentioned that one of the goals, broader goals of this Central Coast effort is to essentially create a prototype network, if you will, that we can learn from when this effort is considered for expansion throughout the state.
Right. And it's my understanding that the reason the whole coast is too big,
right,
and we'd get overwhelmed by just the size and complexity. Mm-hmm. So we're taking a smaller area to do a pilot, and we'll learn from doing that lessons that would then be rolled out when doing the other regions. So it'd be done sequentially rather than in parallel.
So from a scientific perspective, that learning process, you have different reserves that include either different habitat types, different habitat representation. They may have different access restrictions, different purposes, right? From a scientific perspective, if you have multiple, as well as from a network, thinking about larval connectivity across similar reserve types, if you have multiple reserves of similar objectives, that allows you then to make better assessments of the consequence of establishing those kinds of reserves. The smaller the region that you consider that you're going to place those that variety of different kinds of MPAs within will then constrain the number and kinds of reserves that you can consider. And so in that context, I think my concern is that as you expand the scope, the scale of the overall region, you do two things. You increase the variety of conditions that you can assess, and you avoid this problem of trying to intense. If you want to hold that constant, and the more you reduce the overall region, the more you intensify the number of reserves that are required to learn something. So maintaining that scale as broad as possible would avoid that problem and allow you to put in a lower density of reserves of a variety of types to learn as much as possible.
You're saying that one role of a network is to have variety, so...
Exactly.
Yeah, sure. I mean, from a scientific point of view, you need a sample of 3 or 6 or 12 or whatever, so the region needs... That's a good criteria for making it big enough so that you can have...
To accommodate that variety.
Whatever meaningful number.
Exactly.
Different reserves.
Right. The smaller that region, the fewer reserves you're likely to have, and therefore the lower the diversity of objectives of each reserve, of the different reserves.
Okay, so I have Doyle and John and Mark and then Steve.
John,
were you
there? A couple points. One, we can learn a little bit from past experiences, and I think this is one of those places in the process where the scientific and sort of the socio-political and the social aspect of the process come to play, because for an example, between point conception and point arena, in the last version of the process, we had three regional working groups to help represent stakeholder interest. And that was based in part upon the stakeholders' own definition of what they could logically talk about. We are only expecting in this Central Coast process to have one stakeholder working group. So that's something to consider in the size definition. That doesn't mean that the region couldn't be larger than one of those three, but it does give you an example. From the scientific side, I think we do need to focus on a couple of the things that have been brought up. Sort of, what are the other biophysical boundaries or biogeographical boundaries in this area? Because I think there are some logical ones. Where do species assemblages change? So we can say that we're focusing on one species assemblage and not another, or not both. And maybe to adjust a little bit what Mike said, certainly this is a pilot project and a preliminary network. But in reality, you know, the whole thing should function as a network when we're done. If the Central Coast is a portion of a network as a starting point, that might be the best we can do to start. So that's something else to consider from the network standpoint.
Okay, I think I'm reiterating a lot of what's been said, but a word that I think helps to understand what's going on is that we're talking about coordination of habitats, species, activities, and people. And if you say we're going to look at the whole Central Coast as our MPA, and I'm not advocating that, but you would coordinate activities within that MPA. There would be some areas of absolute no take. There would be some areas of interest where you would allow certain activities to occur. And what you eventually want to end up with are some MPAs that one may have some activities or some habitat within it that would coordinate and with the next one on down the coast. And so I think the idea of coordination is pretty important to keep in mind.
Mark? Just to paraphrase what I think many have already said, I think the scientific criteria in this part of the document are rather weak. The presence of scientific research is not the same thing as the outcome and the results that are generated by it. And I quite agree with your statement and Jeff's original question about how to bring in some of the specific scientific criteria up front. Secondly, in terms of the criteria that are here, I think some superfluous criteria are the last two that relate to distance members of a regional stakeholder group would need to travel and the availability of departmental personnel. I think this is really turning the problem upside down and saying, where are the people, where are the department people, personnel available? Well, what we want to do is start with the ocean populations, the critical source populations, critical habitat, and let that define the spatial scale, the exact locations. And if the people have to move to the meetings, well, so be it. But this is really an ocean-focused effort.
Steve? I was unclear. The Central Coast project area that's been described as a pilot project, is this designed to be fully support the entire Central Coast area and is going to be a finished product when it's done, or is this a pilot for the Central Coast area and could be expanded to the Central Coast area? So to what extent is what our consideration is going to provide and inform decisions about the whole coast as a one-time decision-making process, or is this, because we've been talking about scales from point conception to point of arena, so I'm unclear about that. The other was that the word network has come up a lot, and I'm wondering, is that an essential objective? Again, this goes back to what are the objectives of these reserves? Is it to establish a network based on scientific information?
The second answer is the easy one. Yes.
Okay.
The Act requires that the current array of MPAs in California be improved to function as a network. It uses that exact phrase, function as a network. And with regards to your Central Coast question, again, I think this is getting back to a little bit of the confusion about what is the project area, the pilot project, versus what is the Central Coast of California. The only reason you are hearing those bounds of point conception to point arena is we had to have a starting place to let people know what you're looking within. The pilot project or the project area is not expected to be the only thing necessary between point conception and point arena when we are complete in 2011. It is intended to be a starting point between now and 2006 that will allow us to get something in the water, as Mike said, as a starting point in that time frame. So if you chose, for instance, the middle third of that area as your project area, or if the task force chooses that based on the criteria we develop, that would not mean that the bottom third and top third would not be looked at later on. They will. The whole coast has to be looked at later on. So that's a key point.
But Steve, there's another. Your question was, is this a dress rehearsal for the Central Coast, or is this the real plan for the Central Coast? It's my understanding this will be the plan for the Central Coast. Although it's a pilot for the rest of the state.
Well, it's a pilot for the Central Coast, too, though. It is the real plan for whatever project area you determine. But the rest of that area that you will not be looking at in this project needs to be looked at.
There is just one way of putting it is that there has been no decision on how many project areas there are on the Central Coast. There could be one. Or there could be one plus. In the previous go-around, there were three sub-regions within that region. So if it is anything less than the entire area, then it will be, in a sense, a pilot for the Central Coast as well. At the end of that project, it's conceivable that we would dispense with the northern and southern boundaries of what we're calling the Central Coast and choose another approach. But what we needed was some bounds on where to start. There was no preconception about how large that area should be within the Central Coast. And these are all important issues that you're raising that really haven't been addressed.
One thing, just so you are absolutely clear, though, Secretary Chrisman did say it will not be conception to arena. Okay, so just remember that. It's not going to be there. Okay, so the reason we're coming up with criteria is to determine what within that is a logical project area.
So I have, Laura, are you?
I'm going to grab one, And maybe Steve, you can talk to this too, but I know you've got a burning question because you keep catching my eye. So go ahead, but we're going to try and save public comment and question for a specific part of the day so the team can function. But I know I'm sure it's good.
Well, I'm a fisherman. I'm going to stand up. I'm a fisherman, and so my concern, of course, is that we're able to fish. So my concern is right now, and then I understand the MPA process. I've been in since the beginning of the Rock Cod FMP. In fact, I was on the FMP for the Rock Cod. But that's where the focus is our Rock Cod situation, not our salmon situation or stuff. That's how I see it. Right now, we are only allowed to fish from the beach to 20 fathoms. So I want you to consider that when you consider these MPAs. That's all we can fish for rock cod, between the beach and 20 fathoms. Now, 20 fathoms to 200 is closed to us on the whole coast. Right now, you've got an MPA the whole coast of California.
So
far as Rock Cod goes. So consider us, please, when you're doing these MPAs. I know we have to have some closed areas. I understand that. But where you place them can make a lot of difference to whether we as fishermen have a place to fish. You know, it's gotten, we used to have 15 fish. Now we're down to 10. I mean, we used to have 20. Now we're down to 10. Now we're fishing 5 months out of the year instead of 12. I mean, it's getting smaller and smaller. Now with the MPAs coming in, you're going to get a fight from the fishermen. I'm going to tell you right now. There's a coalition that doesn't think that these MPAs should be handled right now. For one reason, you've got outside money that somebody's...
Let's
you don't want to go
with that. Yeah, because what we're talking about is picking the project area. We're not talking about picking MPAs.
Okay, got it. One more question, short question then. Is Morro Bay below Conception?
No.
It's inside
Conception. It's north
of Conception. Okay. Yeah.
So we're gonna take public comments at a specific time. We're gonna take public comments at a specific time.
So Steve, have you retired your card? You had your card.
I was just gonna make a point. John noted that we divided up this region into three sections before, and it was partly a stakeholder issue, but it was also partly that there's some pretty sharp biogeographic breaks within this region for certain groups. I mean, it depends upon what you're focusing on as to what that would be. We know where those are. I mean, so I think if we really wanted to do this within a biogeographic region, we can make some rational decision on the basis of distribution and distributions of a number of different species. That stuff is known very well. The other thing is, I think there are really two aspects of networks we've got to keep in mind here. One is capturing this kind of diversity of things aspect, but the other is, from a functional standpoint, is actually repetition of MPAs within the same situation that really deal much more with issues of sustainability and connectivity between them, where you're actually having them in similar kinds of situations. And so there, kind of the spatial scales of the distribution and repetition of habitats really comes into play, which we talked about a little bit. And there's actually some fairly regular spacing of capes and headlands along the coast of California that it's not just a random distribution of those things. They're actually, you know, there's something like 150, 200 kilometers apart with a fairly regular spacing, which really drives where you see the big upwelling filaments and a whole variety of other kinds of regular aspects of habitat spacing along the coast. So it starts creating some scales of repetition as well as the scale of diversity that come into play in this. But in terms of the biogeographic breaks, we could define those. I mean, go around with the expertise you have here in the room, and any group you're interested in, we can tell you exactly where those are within this region to give some potentially biological reason for breaking it up into a little bit smaller chunk.
Wait.
I have a question of clarification. I'm still trying to understand how our ability to set criteria now are constrained by these criteria that have already been previously set down for the Marine Areas Management Act. And that is that there are sort of two kinds of criteria. There are the vague or broadly defined criteria, or those criteria that include the words like minimize and maximize, where we have quite a bit of discretion in defining the criteria. And then there seem to be more absolute criteria that if they're binding here are going to cause us more problems. And so there are just two criteria that occur in the three major kinds of marine protected areas in California that I think could be potentially very constraining. The first is the criteria three in marine reserves, marine protected marine parks, and marine conservation areas is the proposed site has historically received relatively little fishing effort. And number four, designation of the proposed site is not likely to have a significant negative socioeconomic impact on those who have traditionally used the areas. Are those binding criteria?
Where are you getting that?
This is from the appendix. Mm-hmm. Is material for appendices of the master plan framework.
Is that information necessary to... That's part of the information necessary for network proposals?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not a mandated criteria for MPAs.
And that was the question.
Nor is it intended to be a criteria. It is a criterion. It is intended to be... That is information that a proposal for MPAs would need to provide. So that's very different than what we're talking about.
It says excerpted from the California State Interagency Coordinating Committee for MMAs.
Right. That committee came up with proposed outline of material necessary for any proposal coming in, and we are coming up with information necessary for proposals. I think that's on our agenda later today.
So do we have any kind of criteria that we have to consider as binding, or that set the boundaries of what we can consider?
Not in discussing the Central Coast. No. Again, all we're doing here is coming up with criteria to select a Central Coast project area. Okay, we're not. This does not relate to criteria for selecting any individual MPA.
Okay.
Nor any, and that's why you see what you've got here. These are things that, somewhat as Steve said, is you've got conception to arena. How might you narrow that down?
So the project area can include many spaces, areas that do not have marine protected areas.
Oh, absolutely. No, yeah, the project area, then you're going to go look within that project area to determine, are MPAs necessary? If they're necessary to help be part of the statewide network, where would you put them? And where would you put them based on concerns like this and concerns like you've heard from other folks?
Is a criteria that I heard suggested is that boundaries ought to coincide with the headlands.
Yes. Well, we talked about biophysical boundaries, and that's something that isn't really in this set of criteria. So, it's been taken. Jeff?
I just think that I'm still not getting closure on the criteria for choosing an area. I'm starting to understand there's a distinction between choosing an area and an MPA. However, I don't think that gets you out of the hard work that is required. And I recommend that we try to think about the end members. And I heard Rick say, pick something clear metrics and clear successes. And I also heard diversity of benefit as a goal, which larger areas, lots of MPAs inside it. And I don't think those two can be, will end you up with the same pilot area. And so I would encourage us to, or you to let us know which one we're talking about.
Well, it seems to me that this is just one of those situations in which it will be important to present the task force with the alternate ways of proceeding. I don't know that, you know, there's both of them, you can make persuasive arguments for both of them. And
I guess I don't see the point arena to point conception boundary. I would have used Oregon and Mexico, what I'm hearing, because there isn't, so far, we haven't said anything that limits it other than it's smaller than the whole state. But I have heard no real criteria that limits it to that.
I think there are given resources allocated to this, so right. It has to be doable.
But we could spend infinite resources in any piece that you want to talk about, so I think that's...
I think that there are a limited resource for it.
And it was a very deliberate decision in terms of the design of the entire initiative. I mean, it is a matter of trying to match resources with a reasonable goal. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the problems with the previous efforts, is that they were, in a sense, undercapitalized. And so we're trying to adjust in terms of timing and scale so that we can get something fairly significant.
Maybe if we rephrase the question to you a little bit, it will help focus in on this. Given the knowledge that you are choosing a study area in which to create an MPA network, or I should actually say improve on the existing array of MPAs that are there already, what scientific guidelines would you use to decide on where to do that? You know, I have heard a few that help you make that decision. Clearly, there are some social, political decisions that are more important in making the selection for the project area, and that's really a lot of the things you see in this document. I know scientifically the distance a stakeholder has to travel is worthless in that decision, but in actually managing a process, it's very important. And I can guarantee the process will fail if you can't get the advice and input from the people who need to be involved. And so that becomes an important criterion.
So what is that distance?
let me answer you. It's not. There's no magic number. But you know, like you mentioned, and like I mentioned, we have three groups. Think about where people live and where they access the coast. Think about you as a scientist. Sometimes focus on a particular region, and your knowledge may be general in some aspects, but you may have quite a bit of detailed knowledge about some very specific area that you study. So think about those sorts of things.
So I have, let me see, Laura and Lou, Steve, and Mark. So Laura?
I guess I'm hearkening back to the same questions that I'm hearing maybe from Steve, and that is within our project area that we select, is this network that we're going to be examining, is that going to be autonomous, or that's going to be part of this larger network that's going to be... I mean, if we chose a very small area where we could fit maybe one, you know, a 5-mile section of coastline, and we put in one enclosure... That clearly is not a network, but we envision that it would be part of this larger network that's coming before the year 11, 2011.
Certainly. I mean, the initial network will be designed with other, you know, areas in mind. It's just that after a certain point, this will focus on one segment of the coast. But the law calls for a network.
As our final product.
As the final product. Okay. So it has to fit together in the end.
And will we be revisiting the project area? Or once we've done that project area, we can never revisit?
No. There is specific provision in the Marine Life Protection Act for modifying. And one of the few terms that's defined in the NLPA is adaptive management. So... they left a lot of other things in the air. So, Lou?
I just wanted to mention another thing you might possibly consider in deciding where to put the project area. That would be the potential for enforcement. If marine reserves are placed in an area where no one ever goes, no one ever sees them, the potential is lower for enforcement than the success.
Steve?
My comments were following the things that Jeff was talking about, where this regional range started, and I just wanted to point out that it seems like the borders make this larger area make sense. The southern one is especially well anchored by a headland, mm-hmm. by a biogeographic break. South of there, the fauna and flora are different than north of there in general, and so and Point Arena is similar. That this bigger area that we're asked to choose within is defined, from my perspective, fairly well. Within that area, there are also punctuation points that can be defined similarly. Steve has mentioned headlands, biogeography, what species are there, the way people use the resources. And so using that information, I think we could come up with some biological criteria that would help and be in addition to these social ones. I don't know at what point we start talking vaguely about the kinds of things that would be criteria and start talking more specifically. You should give us a guideline about that. If we're still talking, you know, what the criteria category should be. We've got good endpoints, I think, that are defined biologically and biophysically, and there are other ones in between.
Well, and some of the other ones were headlands. Upwelling was mentioned as another boundary.
Otters stop in the middle of that range. And the communities are very different where otters occur, when they're not. For example,
okay, yes. When this sets up the criteria, when do we actually need to come forward with some alternative proposals to the task force?
Yeah.
Today?
Yeah, essentially.
Okay,
but you've had these for a week.
We need to talk about the criteria, but the actual...
Again, the process here will be to decide upon some criteria that help inform the decision on where to put this project area. The task force intends to decide on a project area, not at their meeting on Monday, but at their meeting in February. If this group, I think you have added some very good criteria that we can just add to the list, such as known biogeographical breaks along that area. And that's something that's concrete that we can provide them with an answer with right away. Some of the other things maybe you can't provide right away as criteria for knowing where to pick this project area. Then the task will be, once we've established these criteria, which does need to happen right away, where do you go? Based on those criteria, where do you go? And the reason to have criteria is so that you're not just picking a place for no reason at all.
So let me see. I've got Mark and Mark and Steve and Steve and then Rick. So,
John, you raised your concern about the process failing if, for example, it was too geographically separate from where people would actually want to go to attend meetings. Well, I'm concerned that the MPAs might fail if they're situated for the wrong reason. And just hypothetically, suppose Lou's model of Dungeness crab populations, now he won't defend himself, suggests that there is a critical source patch of Dungeness reproductive adults, of Dungeness crab, that must be maintained in order for there to be viability of the downstream elements of the population of Dungeness crab. But that patch of ocean environment happens to be geographically far removed from where anybody happens to live or where there's a concentration of people. Well, I'd be very concerned if we'd say, well, we won't put the MPA there. That's not an important criterion because people won't be able to come to the meetings.
And in some ways, I think that's why biogeographical breaks are critical to this, because of that very issue. Also, any area we choose, you risk that. If you choose Conception to Arena, you may exclude some population that its source for reproduction lies somewhere different. Something you would have to take into account when you're actually citing MPAs in that area, if your desire for that MPA is to help sustain Dungeness crab fishing over time, then that would not be a logical place to put.
Or Carr?
So, to quickly summarize, it seems like the guiding criterion that you receive from this group is that it's dependent on biogeographic regions, right? That you want to encompass a biogeographic region. You don't want to straddle biogeographic discontinuities, mm-hmm. unless, in fact, you can encompass substantive, if not multiple, whole biogeographic regions. So, I mean, I guess I'd like to move the conversation further to asking, what are then the substantive biogeographic discontinuities in this region between Point Arena and Conception? And to my knowledge, the only substantial biogeographic discontinuity that I'm familiar with is the Golden Gate. And you have to be filled with a room of people that really know a lot about biogeographic patterns here. So I suggest you get their input. And
So it would be north of that or south of that.
Well, but I want to hear from other people that have biogeographic expertise as well.
Well, let me suggest, I mean, I think we've got, it's clear that we need to have a biogeographical criterion, and perhaps we can work that into sufficient language. But in the coming weeks, perhaps we can consult more closely about what those specifically might be. And use the criteria more or less as a placeholder for that.
Are you saying, Mark, that it's either the whole region or it's divided at the Golden Gate?
that
I use the
if
golden
somebody
gates.
Came back with a proposal and said that, well, it straddles the Golden Gate, they'd say that's not a good.
Right. Then and using the Golden Gate as an example of any possible what people would agree to be a substantive discontinuity,
really
I would say
helpful.
Yes, because the few reserves that you might place to the north of that discontinuity are going to contribute little to the overall network below that, and jeopardize those reserves to the north of the discontinuity by not being networked.
Yeah, and I let me just maybe do a straw poll. It seems like biogeographic breaks are a logical criterion for choosing a project area. Does that make sense to the team? Okay, so we can add that one. Does that not make sense to you?
Well, I mean, it seems
one. It's not the only.
Yeah, I think thinking about biogeographical breaks makes me think that a lot of us came to the table in an MPA frame of mind where the border really matters. Mm-hmm. We're just talking about an area of consideration, right? So we're trying to sort of figure out an area that captures most of the biogeographical region, and if it doesn't capture it all, that's less important than if we're talking about an MPA where we do have very well-defined boundaries. So I think we're spending a lot of time thinking about how we're going to draw these lines when these lines are kind of movable. They're fungible. We can move them around a little bit. And so biogeographical breaks, maybe that makes sense. Maybe hot spots make sense, and we just want to make sure we've got boundaries that bracket the hot spots. I think I don't know the answer to that, but I think that for me, at least until I was enlightened by you, John, I was thinking in an MPA sort of way where the borders were really important. And I don't think the borders are as important as we're talking about.
But I think the borders of the project area are important to Mark's point that it doesn't make a lot of logical sense to straddle a very clear biogeographic break in your project area, because you'll be then having two very different discussions when you do draw those lines.
Yeah. We're now at noon, and if we can go a little bit longer, and right now, Steve, have you once again retired? Steve, Murray, Rick, Linwood, are you still up?
No.
Okay. Astrid, Laura, and Dean. Okay, Steve?
Yeah, I think my interpretation of what we're about in terms of trying to define an area on the Central Coast to start this process is actually more in line with what I would refer to as a phase in this process. Not a pilot, not an experiment, but phase one. So it's phasing on a scale in the sense that once the process plays out on whatever area is defined, we have essentially our first set of MPAs, whatever they look like. And so I think we all ought to be on the same page with regard to that, because I think it has a real relevance with regard to the size of the area that one needs to select. The second point I'd like to make that follows from that is that if that's true, then whatever happens in that first area is going to influence what happens in areas up coast and down coast from that first area. Because one of the goals here is to come up with some networking, and hence, once you have your first set in, this will then have some bearing on where your next set of MPAs follow, both up coast and down coast. So the biogeographic boundaries are really important for that reason. And secondly, I think that the size of the area needs to be one that is sufficient size so that it can provide a good sort of seed or kernel for moving up and down from there.
Rick?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that the boundaries are very important from the phase standpoint and from the biological standpoint. And I kind of get the feeling that we're being asked to come up with a criteria when we know the answer, but you know we're not supposed to tell the answer. And so it seems like that with the people in this room, we could come up with 3 or 4 or 5 X number of possible boundaries that could give the Blue Ribbon Task Force an idea of what we think would be appropriate. And it seems to me that that would make sense.
Is there any reason we can't?
That's a great idea. If the team feels that they're not going to spend all day talking about nuances of boundaries. That's a great idea. That, and then you can apply these criteria to those suggestions and see do they make sense based on the other criteria. They're just recommendations, and I'd hesitate to say I don't think. I certainly know that we don't have a specific idea of what the answer is within the Central Coast. I know that in the discussions about the Central Coast and what to call the Central Coast, I did a bit of research on what the Central Coast is called, and I can tell you there's about 20 definitions out there, both scientific and geopolitical, as to what the Central Coast is. And I've got a map of that I can share. I don't know if I have it today. But, you know, something to remember that is within those definitions, there are fish and game and National Marine Fisheries Service definitions of certain zones within the Central Coast by which we regulate fisheries. And those zones aren't based on just wild guesses. They are based in some cases on fish populations and in some cases on social breaks and where people fish. So...
John, can we make an assignment in this group now for somebody to go and come quickly back with if you say that this has been thought about a lot, what the 3 or 4 or 5 options might be?
What I was going to suggest is if we could finish this round of speakers and then break for lunch, and then you can caucus and perhaps come back with some boundaries. Is that a reasonable approach? So right now, we can go, say, to 12:30 this time. And who I've got are us, Astrid, Laura, Dean, John, and Steve. So, Astrid?
All right, thanks. Well, I'll state the obvious. The social scientists and economists are in this round are outnumbered by all you natural scientists. I don't want to lose a point Linwood made much earlier about the sort of human geographic boundaries that are quite real and don't just reduce to policy process, sort of social process type concerns. From a monitoring and scientific research perspective, it matters quite a bit where different user activities take place, at what intensities, and so on and so forth. So I would suggest that we recognize that in an explicit criterion that we would also forward to the task force.
Laura?
I would say that after we've laid down these biogeographic breaks, which I think we probably do very soon, that we would probably have, say, 3 or 4 different areas within this Point Arena to Point Conception area. And then it seems to me that the question is, do we want to tackle a place that we think is hard or easy, and that our criteria would follow based on what we think we want to tackle. Do we want to tackle a place where we're going to be interacting with a lot of people and groups and we have a lot of data? Do we want to be tackling a place where there's less fishing, less conflict, less data? I mean, I think that decision may then drive what criteria we decide on. So I'd like to pose that question to everyone. And what is hard and what is easy?
How do you signal an intent to respond?
Because it's on this point, actually.
It is, directly. Yes, directly.
It's
again,
human-related point, I think.
Yeah, and again, I mean, the question you ask, I mean, really, when you're talking about easier areas or less conflicted areas, what you're saying is you want less diversity of user types. Now, again, from a social science and economic science perspective, now you're losing your sort of diversity of your sample. And again, if the sort of the pilot area is supposed to scale up to the rest of the state, I, for one, would be interested in seeing sort of the... You know, the seeds planted for
but you might have less user types but biologically diverse and rich resources base.
That's not going to be helpful.
I think probably
yes,
this
I think
is.
It is.
Yeah, I want both.
I think that's what
you mean. This reflects that these criteria are not weighted.
No.
And really, it's the weighting gets to be the task of the task force. Because there is going to have to be a decision of how to weigh these various considerations, and I would assume that those sorts of concerns about do you pick a hard spot or an easy spot is not to put too much of a point on it is going to be one of the issues they'll be over.
So let's just ask that no new cards come up because. We'd like to leave a moment or two for some public comment.
I've got four more. Dean, and then John, Steve, and
I put mine down.
Oh,
thanks.
Thank you.
And I'll keep my comments very brief because in some ways they're reiterating what's been said. And it was just, I wanted to make a comment on the human element and that, you know, it is a very important element, and I'm hoping that we can be creative in dealing with that element and that, you know, we shouldn't have to think about folks necessarily getting in their cars and having to drive to particular meetings, but perhaps in this age of technology we can link people in meaningful ways. With video conferencing or such, if the biology really does drive a larger area and we want to bring the stakeholders together within that area, maybe we can come up with some solutions that allow us to cast a broader net and bring people in through non-traditional sorts of means.
John?
Actually, much of the conversation has gone the way I wanted to endorse and support, which is that sometimes it's valuable in developing criteria to try their application in a straw fashion and market it a bit. I think there's only one divide, and here's what it is. So I think you'll learn something about your criteria, and if, as a matter of fact, you can use them, that's the good criteria. If you can't use them, then we can say we want biodata geographic criteria, and everyone then continues to fight for 2 years, so we ought to try to find a way to test them. The second thought was, in addition to user communities and on the social side, there's also the, I'll call it the policy competence overlay. And that's part how we've collected information and how we organize ourselves to make decisions about these areas. And that's been mentioned a little bit in how they've been regulated and what the enforcement capacities are. It's another set of ways of thinking about how you move forward in the future, somewhat different kind of the criteria. I'd be happy if we made some progress on starting out the first sort of straw testing of the biogeographic after launch. That's a great idea.
Steve?
I want to return to what I brought up earlier. Before we get down to the point where we start talking about specific headwinds and points, I still am not clear exactly what the objective of this is. And so I know it was said to establish a network, but how would one measure success? What is it that is it purely a conservation of biodiversity? Is that it? Or so is can at some point I'd like to see a clear statement about what the goals and objectives of these reserves are, because I think that's essential to getting people to understand why we're even doing this, and that will. That's a real important issue to me.
There's, an important distinction between the criteria for a reserve and the criteria for this phase one.
Right. But our discussions about setting up scientific criteria are all leading towards some management goal that is going to be accomplished, hopefully, at some point in the future.
The management goals are pretty clearly, as clear as legislators can be spelled out in Marine Life Protection Act. And I think that is certainly the framework within which we are operating. Those are kind of the values and principles that we want to achieve through MPA networks. So.
And just for the sake of it, I'll read them.
Okay.
So this is his attachment A?
No.
Okay. because there's a lot of statements of what these are going to do.
The I'm not sure what it's actually. What's the heading on it? Well, anyway, the Marine Life Protection Act. Yeah. The Marine Life Protection Act, which is page 23 on the document that's, I forget what the document is called, but.
It's in the appendices.
Yeah, the appendix. Are the goals of the Marine Life Protection Act as stated in state law. And the intent of the Marine Life Protection Act is to create a marine life protection program with the following goals, and there's six of them. To protect natural diversity and abundance of marine life and the structure, function, and integrity of marine ecosystems. To help sustain, conserve, and protect marine life populations, including those of economic value, and rebuild those that are depleted, to improve recreational, educational, and study opportunities provided by marine ecosystems that are subject to minimal human disturbance and manage these uses in a manner consistent with protecting biodiversity, to protect marine natural heritage, including protection of representative and unique marine life habitats in California waters for their intrinsic value, to ensure that California MPAs have clearly defined objectives, effective management measures, and adequate enforcement, and are based on sound scientific guidelines, and to ensure that the state's MPAs are designed and managed to the extent possible as a network. Those are the six goals of the Marine Life Protection Act, and the program may include areas with various levels of protection, but must include the following: an improved marine life reserve component consistent with the guidelines, and by marine life reserve, they mean no-take state marine reserve as currently defined. Specific identified objectives and management and enforcement measures for all MPAs in the system, and provisions for monitoring, research, and evaluations to facilitate adaptive management, provisions for educating the public in a manner that encourages public participation, and a process for the establishment, modification, or abolishment of existing or new MPAs established in the program. So that's it. That's
so the guiding principles of what we should be discussing really should be encompassed by these six statements, the way I look at it.
And remember that we have decided in this initiative process to start with part of the state to meet those.
I understand that.
So, we're going to provide some time for public comment, and then we'll break at 12:30. And those of you who can get together and discuss boundaries and come back with some options, if you could get together at caucus over lunch, that would be terrific and would allow us to be much more specific in going back to the task force. And then, what time do we want to get back together?
Well, we'll take an hour.
So we'll be back here at 1:30.
Let me make one caveat about the public comment. We're focusing on something very specific now. We want to ensure that we get your views and impressions. Please hold your comments to those specific to choosing a project area within the Central Coast. We're not talking about where to locate individual MPAs or how an individual MPA, if it is established, might impact you. We're talking about the logical way to select a project area. And then you have one more.
Okay.
And maybe tell us who you are, please.
My name is Bill Smith. I'm just going to run the CPFB Festival Tide at Happening Day. There's a couple points that I wanted to go over here. First off, we're talking about boundary lines, and these boundaries have already been set up by the Pacific Fisheries Management Council. There are very specific points already set and established by the council all along the whole coast, actually, but specifically in California, they've been very well defined. That was in regards to the Pacific Fisheries Management Council and its marine preserve, which is the world's largest along our coast, there are portions of that marine reserve that fall within the state waters. So if you you're going to look at your marine preserves, then you should really consider the areas that overlap, specifically waters that are over 120 feet deep. There are many portions along our coast that already are. There are many portions in the state waters that already are within the MLPA system that already exists. And that then, as far as I see, is this august body has to go directly to those areas. So there's a mandated area set aside right away that is an area that needs to be specifically considered. Let's see. And the other issue around that is that within these areas, there's you're talking about the impacts of different kinds of not only user groups but things that impact these marine preserves. Okay, most of the talk here has been talking about harvesting of species by fishermen or by user groups. I have not heard mentioned one word really to deal with the kelp populations, which in many, many respects have been directly affected by agricultural runoff. And so is this not also an area that this body should also consider if you're looking to do marine, if you're looking to protect the species within these preserves? You also need to address the agricultural runoff, both aspects of pesticides and the fertilizers. As you all know, these are major pollutions that have affected the diversity of our populations, as well as the user groups that are taking species out of the area. Let me see. I think I covered pretty good. I know I've got. I'm trying to keep it all within your ramifications. In regards to which areas to pursue as far as actively trying to close or to put into preserves, my thinking is that if you go to an area that has less impact by fishermen or by user groups, these are going to be areas that would tend to be more diverse in their species than areas that have a higher impact use by the fishermen or by user groups. So my recommendation or my leaning would be more towards the areas that have a less of an impact, because they're going to give you a larger biological diverse area. And then speaking, one last issue around the diversity of the areas, there are a lot of species that, yes, are specific to certain portions of the reef, but there are also very large biogeographic areas of species that will encompass larger portions of the coast. California has the largest temperature gradient of any state. You go from the warm waters off of San Diego to the cold waters off of Eureka. So we're looking at a major, major temperature change in areas that are that encompass a large area. So there are species that are specific, but there are also species that are very large in their biodiversity.
Thank you. Let me see. Rod?
Thanks, Mike. I'm Rod Fujita, marine ecologist for the Environmental Defense. I think it's a really wise of you to be moving toward this idea of using biophysical barriers, interruptions in the transport and recruitment of organisms. Those would include not only the upwelling things, but the offshore jets, of course, off the points, and the plume off the Golden Gate. Habitat diversity is another really important one that you've discussed, and I think Mark said it, but you need to have a large enough area defined as a project area to allow for replication and real analysis of performance. I also want to emphasize the two other criteria that I think are really important. If one of the goals of this is to demonstrate success on a pilot scale and to scale it up to the rest of the coast, one is, of course, to think about where the constituencies are and who they are and what areas they want to see protected. The NGO community has been working since 1999 as part of these MLPA working groups and also as kind of a civil society process parallel to that formal process to develop constituencies for ocean protection and MPA designation, particularly Surf Rider Foundation, World Wildlife Fund, NRDC, and a whole bunch of different grassroots groups distributed from Point Reyes to all the way to Southern California. So I think that's an important part of the political landscape that you ought to consider when you think about designating this project area. And another one related to the human dimension is, from experience, we all know that when it gets down to developing a network of marine protected areas, it comes down to trade-offs. It comes down to where are the intensive use areas, where are the areas of ecological importance, and how can you trade them off against each other to achieve the ecological criteria or objective of protecting biological diversity and ecological function and network function, but at the same time minimizing the impacts on the user groups. And that's the key to success, is to accommodating those interests. So, again, you know, the project area ought to be big enough and have a diverse enough array of habitat types, enough continental shelf. You know, it's narrow in some parts of the project area, it's bigger in other parts of the area, to allow stakeholders to trade areas off and allow fishing opportunities in some areas if you're going to close off a lot of the shelf in another area. That's the basic idea. And finally, I wanted to mention that I brought with me OceanMap, which is a GIS platform and software that we developed at Department of Defense that displays the gray, the green habitat database. It's interpolated data of about 50 different kinds of habitat off the California coast. And it has an interface that will allow you to draw different scenarios of the project area and calculate the amount of hard substrate, the amount of kelp forest, the amount of unconsolidated stuff. It's a fairly useful way to characterize the different kinds of project area options you might want to think about designating. And Mary Gleason of the Nature Conservancy is also here. We've been working together to compile databases on seabird distribution, marine mammals, ground fish diversity and abundance, the habitat suitability and probability models that were developed through the EFH process. And ASTRA has also been working with the same platform, OceanMap, to develop information on user intensity resource use. We have similar information shape files on non-consumptive use intensity in this area. And so our hope is to bring all these data layers together into a support tool that you guys can use to inform your decisions, and the Blue Ribbon panel can use to inform their decisions. I have the data with me. I can run it on my laptop if you want. We also have packets of information that describe the tool and a couple of publications related to the data we've done so far.
Thank you, Mr. Weber. My name is Jesus Ruiz. I'm state coordinator for the National YMCA School of Program. I'm also a diver representative in the statewide interest group. And I agree with a lot of that has been said before. I'd like to touch on a couple of points. First of all, we did work with Environmental Defense to enter our dive sites and other non-consumptive interests into that program, so that would be available to you through them. Before I forget, I'm going to try and touch on a couple of things that were said before. As far as making a choice between a rich ecosystem or serving the stakeholder interest group, that you give and take on the other. In other words, you're going to have a rich ecosystem, less population or more population serving the state group, and less less of the rich marine environment. I don't think that's necessarily the case. As all of you are marine scientists, you've all done marine science and diving along the coast. Let's take, for example, Big Creek. That's been a marine reserve now for quite some time, and I understand from the studies there hasn't been a significant increase in marine in the ecosystem there. On the other hand, you have Point Lobos, which is close to a large population, which is a thriving marine ecosystem. And on the other hand, you have the Monterey area. Yes, you have a lot of runoff, especially in Pacific Grove, but if that was set aside as a marine reserve, I think that would come back tremendously. So it's not an either or. I think it's more complex than that, and I think that's a science question that you guys are more able to come up with some conclusions from that than some of us others. As far as the scuba industry is concerned, the scuba diving community, and I'm speaking for the non-consumptive recreational scuba diving community, there's only one thing that really, really matters. Well, there's five that I'm going to be submitting to the chair of the Blue Ribbon Task Force, but after sitting through this today, there's really one that stands out, and that's location, location, location. Yes, there's scuba diving throughout the state. It's heavy in Southern California. In Southern California, they like to go to the Channel Islands. But in the Central Coast that you're considering here, it's really between the breakwater and Monterey down to Point Lobos. And if you're going to take this stakeholder into consideration, which is 1.4 million recreational scuba divers in California, is between the breakwater and Point Lobos. Should you go someplace outside of that, then you've totally ignored one major stakeholder. And if you're to... Okay, I got it. If you were to take that area, there's one area in particular that's critical to us, between the breakwater and including the breakwater to Lover's Cove. For the last 10 years, divers, recreational divers, have been trying to make that a marine reserve. According to Michael Foster, which some of you might know, one of his research papers that he produced, he stated there were 74,000 dives per year between the breakwater and Lover's Cove. That's significant. You have Hopkins there, and then as you go around the corner, you have the Pacific Grove coastline, which has been declared by the citizens of Pacific Grove as a more or less a marine reserve by the new definition. Then you have the Carmel Ecological Reserve, or Preserve, I'm not sure what it's called. Then you have Point Lobos. You have a network there already to work with. You have the diving industry in Monterey. You have the citizens of Pacific Grove and all the other science institutes there that have an interest in seeing that place protected. And it will come back. There have been some institutions there that said this is not suitable. It's overused, it's been exploited, and it'll never come back. I don't think that's the case, and I don't think you believe that either.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
One last, Vern, you have?
Yeah, I'm Vern Gehring, and I'm representing a California Fisheries Coalition, a group of 18 or 20 sport and commercial fishing and coastal communities, and I just have some brief comments I wanted to make on the criteria for selecting.
I'm sorry. Got it.
Okay. For selecting the area, and there's one that's identified here already regarding looking at existing MPAs, and just a comment with regard to that, there's been several comments made with regard to this being a network and the need to look at existing MPAs and closed areas and so forth, and improving that system and making sense out of that and integrating it with possibly new MPA areas. And I think in looking at existing MPAs, and not just what's written here, but I think you also have to look at what's the purpose and intended function of those existing areas and how successful are they today and what can be tweaked around to make the area that you're looking at a feasible kind of a sub-network or fit into the network system. So if you've been looking at the existing purpose and function of those MPAs as well as what the science is there. There's been discussion a lot about kind of the purpose of the whole MPA MLPA Act and the whole network, and I think that if you look at the statutory purposes, you see that clearly the legislature, I think, intended that MPAs look at unique and rare areas of the marine ecosystem and try to then increase or ensure the protection of those areas by the authority and the weight that comes along with an MPA designation. And it also, I think, steers you to look at areas that may be not pristine or unique necessarily now, but could be if they were protected by MPA. So I think, and it also directs, as mentioned earlier, coordinating with other agencies, I think it directs you to look at other than just direct impacts on the marine environment now, but indirect impacts. And there was a little bit of comment earlier about
about upstream pollution and coastal and terrestrial impacts, so I think you have to look at the indirect impacts that might affect your project area. And another step of that, I think you need to give some thought to looking at future anticipated impacts or trends, not only in the marine environment, but the terrestrial environment. What are the trends, what's evolving in the future that might impact the success, the working of an MPA system? So, thank you.
Okay, Karen, and actually if we could make it very brief because we do need to get out, have some lunch, come back with some boundaries, and we've got a big agenda this afternoon.
So I'll try to make it short. Brad covered most of my points. I'm Karen Garrison with the Natural Resources Defense Council, and the only point I wanted to make is that I think the legislature envisioned a network design within each bioregion, and you may not be recommending a whole bioregion, but I think it makes sense in the spirit of Steve Berger's point that we want to deal with the major issues in this phase that we're going to be confronting in other phases, which I think is a very good point. The ideal would be to have this phase have an area that's big enough to encompass a network design so we get some experience doing that.
Okay, and if you could focus on criteria and keep it to about a minute, please. Back to your name and
Ben Slater. I'm with the Coastside Fishing Club here in the Bay Area. I just a real quick comment on the designation of this larger area, and that is to consider impact or consider intensity of use for no other reason than the quickest way to drive away many of your stakeholders will be to expose them to a prolonged process. And even worse than that would be multiple processes. And if you split this general geographic area here, say in the middle, say at the Golden Gate, you'll be exposing this regional fishery here to two processes, one north, one south. And I have a strong feeling that would really do more harm than good in this overall process. Just a final point of clarification. Are we talking about a network or networks of marine protected areas for the whole state?
Well, the statute says network. So it's got to hang together. And it's being assembled in pieces. But the notion is that ultimately it's going to be a network. And I'm sure we could have some very, very long discussions over what network means when you're talking about 1,100 miles of coastline. So, Richard, you had a comment on the criteria?
Yeah, my name is Richard Charter, and I'm with the Oceans Program of Environmental Defense. And as you've recognized this morning, there are existing marine protected areas, one type of which is the National Marine Sanctuary. And I'd just like to point out that this is not the first time, obviously, a lot of you know, that folks have gotten together in a room and tried to figure out what's appropriate in terms of defining boundaries for protected areas. And I had the privilege starting in 1980 to recognize that local governments, who I was working for, had a role in determining these places. And the places they picked are now four National Marine Sanctuaries off the coast of California. The three that overlay your particular your broad study definition are the Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary, being outside of it, but the Monterey Bay Sanctuary is inside of it, the Gulf of the Farallones Sanctuary is inside of it, and the Cordell Bank National Marine Sanctuary is inside of it. And the boundaries of those three sanctuaries were not determined arbitrarily. In fact, each of those sanctuaries had its own draft EIS, final EIS, NEPA process. A lot of them had socioeconomic studies associated with them. And each of those sanctuaries, I just remind you, and it's obvious, they include state waters. They come to the high tide in each of those areas. Monterey Sanctuary has had an ongoing working group on marine protected areas for the last few years. I've had the privilege of serving on the Sanctuary Advisory Council for Gulf of the Farallones, which has had a fishing working group that has looked at these kind of things, the need for marine protected areas, additional protections, within the sanctuaries, and that group would like to have a working relationship with both the Blue Ribbon Panel and your body in terms of, we have a database that NOAA developed, Satie Arame of the NOAA Coastal Data Center, for a study area for the National Marine Sanctuaries that goes really from roughly Diablo Canyon up to Wallala. The reason we took it to Wallala is because at the original outset, when the Gulf of the Farallones Sanctuary was originally created in 1980, it was proposed to go to the Russian River. And there's a bill introduced in Congress right now to extend it northward to Wallala. So these sanctuaries didn't happen by accident. There are studies ongoing to expand them. The GIS that's been developed for the sanctuaries is actually interactive with the Ocean Map program that Rod's brought with him and is prepared to offer you as a tool. But the one thing that we've learned in the sanctuaries is that there is an interconnectedness between these three sanctuaries, Cordell Bank, Gulf of the Farallones, and Monterey Bay. And we have a mandate in the sanctuary program to protect the health of the ecosystem. And it looks to us, and I'll just phrase it briefly, it looks to us like they are linked and that what's feeding them is a huge upwelling off Cordell Bank that's feeding all the way down. And I just suggest you think regionally, because you are defining a study area and it does overlap with some existing federal protections. Thank you.
Thanks.
So it's now 12:45, and sorry you don't get more time. There's lots of opportunities for lunch across the street and about a block down in the corridor. There are quick places where you can grab something and bring it back if you'd like, if it's not inside places to be there. If you can be back here at 1:30 ready to go, that would be great. Bathrooms are hard to find in this building, but if you go out the glass door and to the first sort of major entryway on your right, and then left, and then right again a few times, you will find bathrooms. I've tried following one wall all the way around the building. It doesn't seem to work. I actually think it's a maze. But they are out there. Thanks again, and we'll see you in 45. I'm going to go to the next one.